Hello, and welcome to another life-changing episode of Sacred Cheese of Life. This is Emma. This is episode 50, I think. Yes, 50. And I'm going to do it about one of my favorite characters and what makes a good character a good character. So there you go. One of my favorite characters of all time is Murderbot. Murderbot is amazing. And I know I talked a little bit about Murderbot in general, but mostly that was about the writing and the weird comma and thing, or just and being misused, because it does drive me crazy when I read those books. I'm like halfway through the third one in my latest reread. I reread them multiple times a year, every one of the books. Hi, puppy. The animals are restless. The window is open. This is going to be great. So Murderbot as a character, there's something about this character, and I've been thinking about it in regards to Flora Post, because I just reread Cold Comfort again, trying to put my finger on what it is about Flora Post that works. Because on paper, I mean, not on paper as a book, but like, you know, on paper, it doesn't seem like she ought to work. But she does work. And it's odd because she doesn't have this thing that I find in Murderbot, which is to say, there's a kind of an internal engine, which is, see, that's a funny thing to say about Murderbot. If you don't know who Murderbot is, go read all the books and then come back and listen to this, because I'm going to ruin them all. And also, you should read them because they're really wonderful. So there's an internal engine, which is, I guess, contradiction or conflict or discontinuity, something like that. It's elements that are fighting against each other. And I think every good character has that. And I think the more characters you think about, the better this the better this will sound, because every really good character has elements that fight against each other. Think about some good characters. Who is it? I mean, in Murderbot, it's obvious, okay? Murderbot is a construct, human and machine. So right there, you've got these two different halves that aren't necessarily in sync. They fight against each other. They may be in conflict. But also, it, and it's always it is disaffected, like a disaffected youth, only it's a disaffected Murderbot. It's disaffected because it's been misused and mistreated, and it was created to be a thing, but it's obviously a person, okay? And the one I'm reading right now is Rogue Protocol, which I brought with me because the titles are nonsense and I can never remember what they are. In this book, Murderbot refers to people. It might actually have been the last book. I'm not sure. But Murderbot refers to people and how it's not a person. And when you've got anybody who's saying they're not a person, first of all, they're wrong because they are a person. If you can say that, you're a person. And it's just a very interesting thing that the whole series gets into, like who's a person, who's not a person. Is this weird little bot Mickey a person? I don't know. It seems to have... And I mean, what makes a person is another whole question that I think the whole series gets into. This series gets into a lot of really complex sort of metaphysical and psychological questions that on the surface don't seem like they're part of this sort of sci-fi series about a cyborg, really. A cyborg is a human machine compilation sort of thing. And I spent a bunch of time in the 90s obsessed with this in fiction, with the cyborg in fiction. I was so into it. I even considered doing a PhD on it, except I had been studying. I mean, if I had been in the English department still, I would have done that, but I was in comparative literature and I've been studying ancient and medieval languages and literature because I love languages more so than the literature. But I am fascinated by the cyborg, and I even taught a class on this later on. Like, I taught actually multiple classes on this. Boundaries of the Human at Temple University. I probably mentioned that before. When is a person no longer a person? And we have a lot of fights about that, truly. Like, when, and nowadays especially, people are getting into trouble by saying, you know, oh, well, they came here illegally, therefore they don't have any rights. Like, well, that's not how that works. The Constitution protects everyone, citizen and non-citizen alike. It doesn't matter how someone came here. They're still protected. They still have rights. So, like, people want to draw that line and say, okay, these people aren't people. We don't have to treat them like people. It's really messed up that we do that. We're always trying to draw circles that leave people out instead of drawing circles that bring people in. And I don't know why, except we want to be special, I guess. We're still special, even if other people are also in our group. I don't know where that comes from, but maybe you know more than I do about that. So Murderbot is someone who has not been treated as a person and who is not entirely sure that it is a person and doesn't eat, doesn't drink. I mean, I have problems with this on a science fiction level. I have problems that it's constantly shooting out of its arms but never reloads. Like, and maybe that's energy. And then it goes into a recharge cycle to get more energy back, like when it's like when your phone is down to 10% and you have to plug in. But Murderbot does not plug in, just recharges. Like, how? Your perpetual motion machine? I don't know. I don't know how that works. But anyway, that sort of hand-waving aside, Murderbot is a person who is part machine. And lots of people are part machine. Lots of people have mechanical parts. They have hearing aid implants, or they have, you know, replacement knees or shoulders or whatever, or they have artificial limbs, or they have a replacement heart valve, or they have an artificial heart, whatever. There's lots of people with artificial parts. And the people who want to draw the circles that keep people out will go, okay, yeah, but they're mostly human. So, like, what are you saying? Like, 50% is the line? That's nonsensical. Why should it be 50%? And it just feels racist to me. And the reason that comes to mind all the time is when I first read the Murderbot series, the very first book, which I think I read 3 times in a row. The first time I read it, I was like, this is amazing. And then I ran to the bookstore and made Gibran sell me all the rest of the Murderbot books. But also, I said when I first read it, because I was teaching early American lit, I said, this is a slave narrative. This is an escaped slave narrative. And it is, the whole series is an escaped slave narrative. Murderbot is essentially enslaved. It does not get paid for its work. It is expected to work and not get paid. It is sentient and it has to work and not get paid. That's slavery. Like, that's the definition, right? And it doesn't matter if somebody made you in a lab. Lots of people get made in labs. That doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if you're part mechanical. Again, you know, there's your mother's artificial knees. It's a person, and you can tell it's a person. And people are people. Sorry. It's just so obvious to me that it's hard to talk about. But it's an escaped slave narrative because it had a governor module in its head that made it obey orders or it would get its brain fried. It would get punished by, like, zaps in the brain. Not cool. But also enslaved, right? And then Murderbot manages to turn that off and so has freedom, has free will suddenly, but just keeps on doing its job, going on contracts where it's sent, doing its job to the best of its ability. And this goes back to that initial thing I was saying about the central conflict of a character. The whole time Murderbot says that it does not care about people and it doesn't care about doing its job and it only wants to do it halfway and it just wants to sit around and watch media. Okay, so it's very depressed. It's a depressed cyborg, not uncommon in fiction. However, it's also not true because it does care about people and it does do its job the best it possibly can when it cares about the people. And the very first book is Murderbot on a job helping some, like page 1 and 2 and 3 is helping, and I can picture this in my head, that's how often I've read it, helping these people who are out on a planetary survey doing boring science work or whatever. Like, it does not care about the work and is considering watching TV, basically, in its head. But then they get attacked and it immediately leaps into action and fights back against the thing. It's good at its job and it loves doing its job. Its job is basically its whole reason for being, and it loves it. It loves to do it well and to show how well it can do it. That's not somebody who doesn't care about their job. That's somebody who does care about their job. So it rescues the one person, and the other person's freaking out, and it talks him down. Him? Her? I can't remember. And then gets them out of this crater thing and gets them all the way back to the ship, and it's been seriously damaged, it's hurt, it's bleeding, or as it says, leaking, and is missing like some huge percentage of its body mass that's been eaten by this critter. But it saved everybody. And then someone tries to go outside and get the equipment, and it yells no, which it's not allowed to do. But nobody knows that it's no longer enslaved. And so nobody knows it's not allowed to yell no at them. And so saves that person too. So like saved three people in rapid succession. That is not somebody who doesn't care. And so we've got this central conflict in self-image, which I really enjoy. Like if somebody says, I don't care about people, but they obviously care about people, that's very interesting to me. Why are you saying that when it's not true? Do you know it's not true? Do you not know that it's not true? Do you think? See, I find it fascinating when people are completely unaware of their own personality or their own beliefs or their own their own whole deal. I love that. And I know I never shut up about Chaucer, but Chaucer's whole thing in Canterbury Tales is all these people who don't know their deal and who think that they're one way and say that they're one way, but they're clearly the opposite. They're some other way entirely. And that central conflict, I believe, underlies all of the best characters in fiction, truly. And we can talk a lot more about that later, but it's so important with Murderbot. And I think it drives the entire story, because if we really were reading about a heartless killing machine, it would be super boring. But we're reading about someone who says they're, I mean, Murderbot gave itself the name Murderbot because it doesn't feel like it has any other role in life other than to go and kill a bunch of people. Even though we never really see it do that at the beginning. What do we see? We see caretaker. We see it in a caretaker role. It worries about people. It takes care of people. It shows its concern in very clear ways by planning and prepping and making sure the perimeter is clear. And it's just so thoughtful and caring and generous. And it really likes some of these people, and it really doesn't like others of the people, which I think is also very cool. I'm not sure I would have been smart enough writing it to write something like that, like just disliking somebody. But that also means that's a person. It's a person who likes some people and doesn't like other people. That's one of the traits of people. That's what we're like. We like some people, we don't like other people. It's not a machine. A machine would not do that. We know this, but Murderbot is constantly fighting in its own head about whether or not it's just a machine and not a person. Because, and again, to go back to slave narratives, when you've been treated a certain way your whole life, it affects how you see yourself. Obviously. Obviously. It has to. It can't not. And so that's all wrapped up in this wonderful character. So there's those different elements that are fighting within it. There's the, I'm a disgusting murder machine. I'm a murder bot. Versus, obviously, it's not. It's a caring, generous, helpful, kind, considerate, thoughtful person who thinks of itself as nothing more than a killing machine. Okay, that's awesome. It's also, it likes people. It says it doesn't like people, and it's frustrated with people a lot of the time because people can be annoying. They can be inconsiderate, and they can be loud, and they can be stupid about things, and they never shut up, and there's all these ways you might not like people, but it likes people, and it wants to help people. Is it Rogue Protocol? I think it is, where it gets a ride on this transport with all these people who've sold themselves into chattel slavery, basically. They've sold themselves into a 20-year contract with and they get paid, but they have to pay for food and medical care and all this other stuff. So you know they're not getting any money out of it. And it's a really bad deal. And Murderbot's talking to one of the people and asks, like, okay, so is it like, you know, this measurement of years or the local measurement of years or the company measurement of years or what? Because those are all different. And the guy's like, oh, I don't know. And doesn't understand even why it matters. That's terrible. That's terrible. And it's very hard to watch people be very stupid and make bad choices when you can't save them. And I think, again, it shows what a considerate, kind, thoughtful person Murderbot is. That it cares about these people who have been incredibly annoying for like 20 days and making it solve all of their petty little squabbles. It's so annoying. And yet Murderbot's sad because they're going off into stupid slavery and they sign their lives away for squat, you know? Just terrible. Just terrible. But that's a person who cares. And it's lovely to read this book because the whole time it's going, well, I don't care. And you're like, yeah, you do care. You totally care, or you wouldn't even be talking about how much you don't care. That's a great character trait. Having those conflicts and contradictions within a character when they're saying one thing and you know another thing is true, that also allows us to be part of the story because we're doing part of the math. We're not just being spoon-fed, here's a character who says it doesn't care about people, but obviously does. Like, we have to do that. It's not on the page. We have to do it. And that's why I'm mystified about Flora Post, because Flora Post is on the page. She's not... I guess, though, okay, no, this is how it works. She's sort of making fun of the Starcatters at the beginning. The whole thing is she's sort of mocking the whole deal. And she's acting like she's above it and she doesn't care about these people. But she does come to care about those people. And she helps all of them. She doesn't just, like, get them shunted off into somewhere else. No, she helps them get what they want. That's wonderful. That's kind. So we're up against the same thing, aren't we? Like, this person who is kind and generous and caring and helping people, who says that they're not. Who would have said, like, I mean, there's a wonderful scene at the beginning where she and her friend Mary are looking and they're like, oh, the rest are appalling. They're all appalling. She's like, yeah, but these are interesting and appalling. She likes people. She's interested in people. And yes, she wants to come in and sort of save them from themselves. But the Starcatters need to be saved from themselves. They are a mess. And they're so busy being the stars of their own miserable dramas, like literary dramas, that they need someone to step in and say, but this is what you want. You're not doing what you want. Let's make it so that you do what you want. Oh, somebody needs to do that to everybody. That would be great, wouldn't it? Like, somebody who can actually get through all of your nonsense and say, here's what you actually want. Oh, that is what I want. Welcome to another barking festival starring Tallulah Dog. So, Murderbot takes on these jobs. And in this book I'm reading now, the third one, Rogue Protocol, I have to look at it every time. It has taken on a job to go to this distant spot and check whether this evil company that was killing the people in the very first book is up to nefarious activities far away, based on just an offhand comment by its favorite human, Mensa, in that it sees, like, on the news. And it's like, well, you know what? I'm going to go look and find out, and maybe we can use it to prosecute the bad people. So it's voluntarily traveling across the galaxy or whatever. I don't understand where this whole scope of their locations. And traveling for a long time, doing an annoying, stupid job, taking care of those people who are selling themselves into slavery, and going to do a dangerous thing to find out something that might possibly help its favorite human. That is not... That's not your toaster, okay? And I mean, that actually makes me wonder, well, the Battlestar Galactica Cylons were never really clearly thought out in my mind. They don't seem to be cyborg. Like, it's never explained. So there's a lot of more hand waving. Are they robots? I don't think so, because Sharon has a baby. Are they fake humans? Like, are they artificial humans? I don't know what they are, and it's never clear. And if I ever watch the whole series again, maybe I'll get more insights into that. I don't know. They're artificial, and they want to be human, so I guess they're not. So I'm not sure exactly what they are, but they don't seem to be, I don't know. That would have thrown my whole cyborg thesis into disarray, because who were the various cyborgs I was working on? The original Blade Runner, Data, from Star Trek Next Generation. Who else was there? Who remembers? It was in the 90s. I could probably open up those files right now. Nope. I deleted everything off this hard drive. It's on the external hard drive. It's in the other room. but I could pull up that paper and see. There were a couple who were so interesting to me, and I think it's fascinating the way Martha Wells has specifically excluded this, because it's fascinating and gross the way people always used to immediately make the robots have sex with humans. Like, they're like, oh, it's not real, but it does this. Like, really? Really? And it's constant. And that was the first thing where I was like, what the hell is wrong with you people? Like, when does Data have sex with Tasha? It's like the second or third episode. What are we doing? Why are we doing that? I don't know. And it used to bother me so much that it was almost always a female cyborg and male human. But the more I think about it, the more I think there are actually a bunch of times where it's a male cyborg. Hi, puppy. Like in Marge Piercy's He, She, and It, where this brilliant scientist, and this really bugged my students at Temple. She was like a grandmother. And she built a robot. She built a golem. And she had a physical relationship with it. And they were like, ew, she's so old. Like, oh my gosh, you guys. They were so young. There's also Simon in a Battlestar Galactica movie. I think it's The Plan. I can't remember. I shouldn't even talk about it. But there's a couple where it is the cyborg guy. But I like that Martha Wells specifically excluded that. Like, she keeps... This was, I thought, was very funny also, where she's like, I don't have any parts that you would use to do that. And I was like, you have some. But it means it doesn't have, like, genitalia, but, like, there's, you kind of, anyway, it should know because it has to watch all the video of everyone all the time. But anyway, I thought that was very funny also. Like, it can still probably do some stuff there, Murderbot, if you wanted to. But it doesn't want to. It thinks it's super gross. But the whole time, everything it says is a contradiction. So I don't know. And there's just this moment. It doesn't want anyone to touch it, ever. But when people do, it's such a big deal. And it reminds me of, and I know we could talk all day about psychology and the cyborg, the psychology and the cyborg. There's my thesis. Because it gets so worked up when anybody touches it. Like, people want to hug it, and it's like, no, no hugging. And has an expression, like, it doesn't say what its expression is, but the way people react, they're like, oh, that's a no then. You know, that's like, oh, okay. And that's in the second book. And there's these young scientists, and it has to stay in a motel room or whatever with one of them. And in the middle of the night, the girl is scared and comes in almost snuggles up to its back, but doesn't quite touch, but is like close, right? For comfort. And Murderbot's like, ah, what's it doing? Ah. And turns up its body heat so that the little person can be comforted. But the whole time is like frozen in terror. Like, what's it doing? It's touching me. And I can see writing it why you wouldn't make them actually touch, because Murderbot has, I guess, human flesh over a bunch of its body. Maybe all of it. I don't know. I don't think so, though. I think it has metal feet. I can't remember. It's not always clear, but like, I think if somebody had a whole metal skeleton and guns in their arms and you snuggled up to them, I think you would notice. You would probably notice, I think. It's supposed to be like human from about the waist up, I think. Something like that. Anyway, doesn't matter. But touch is very interesting because it has to pick up people and carry them. And of course it beats people up and throws them around and smashes them into walls. But while it's doing that, it's taking care of other people. So it's a, you know, it's like a, it's a warrior kind of thing. Like, I care for these people by killing those people, which is always another beautiful contradiction. And I have just been watching Leverage Redemption, which of course has Elliot, who's the same way, who's like gentle and caring and loving and beats the crap out of everybody all the time and constantly tells people he doesn't want them hugging him and doesn't want them, you know, being close to him. And he pretends he's all tough and doesn't care, but he's secretly very soft. And then, you know, like, goes to see his dad, and he's crying on the screen, and I'm like, and I start crying, because Elliot's crying. I mean, that guy's a good actor now. I think he's like Boreanaz, where back in the day he was maybe not so much, but now he really is. So that's great that people develop and grow over the years. I love to see that. Man, I love that show. I'm tired of watching TV, though. I never watch TV this much. And it's really cutting into writing time. I haven't done any writing because I've been watching Leverage Redemption instead. Been watching Leverage Redemption instead of writing. No writing at all in the past week. That's terrible, right? I've been reading and watching TV. Not cool. So the inherent contradiction of a character. And I think with Elliot, he has the cooking, which is, of course, the most caretaking possible thing you can do. Feeding people and being such a caretaker. But combining being a caretaker with, a lethal murderbot or a lethal Elliot is a wonderful contradiction. And I think you could go through all your favorite characters and do this. The more of them I think about, the more I find that there's this central thing. There's a central coexistence of two opposing traits or elements that drive that character in such an interesting and cool way. And I don't know what to make of that, except, I mean, maybe everyone knows that already who writes. I don't know. I never heard it, but then, I don't know. I was busy having a panic attack all through my MFA, and again, like I said, we didn't have classes, so it's not like I wasn't paying attention in class. There was no class, so I don't know. Maybe people teach this. Have a central contradiction in every character. I've never heard anyone say that, but now you have, so there you go. You can use that. I really enjoy that. I was just thinking of Elizabeth Bennet, who is funny and sarcastic and independent, yet knows she has to find a husband to take care of her family, because if her father dies, they're all out on their ear and destitute. So you've got this person who needs to find a husband. Like, what a gross thing. And doesn't really necessarily want to. Also, she has to find a husband for economic reasons, but she really believes you need to marry for love. So that's a contradiction. So, and then there's this jackass Darcy, who is the same way, has a central contradiction, and grows and changes as a person. And so I don't know if the central contradiction has to be resolved in the end. I don't think so. I think it has to find a way to coexist and not keep fighting each other. But I don't really know. I don't know. I mean, a resolution is a resolution of a plot, not the resolution of a character's inherent traits, really. Like, when Darcy gets resolved, it's because he sees things more so than he did at the beginning. And he sort of grasps that there's more elements to people's lives than he gave them credit for. Like, being annoyed that her mother is annoying. Yeah, her mother is annoying, but that doesn't make Elizabeth an unpleasant or awful person. Sorry, I can't stop fidgeting. What's new? So, like, he just sort of gets over himself and stops being so judgy. It is called Pride and Prejudice, after all. And she gets over his rudeness and starts figuring out there's a lot more to him than she saw in the beginning. So, like, they both just expand a little bit and sort of understand the world a little better. And it's easy to be judgmental or quick to anger or whatever. Or quick to be hurt. I mean, surely her feelings were hurt. She doesn't act like it when he says that rude thing at the beginning, like, she's not pretty enough. There isn't anyone here pretty enough to tempt me, or whatever it is he says that's so mean to her. But she laughs and she acts like it's a funny thing, and she's going to go to, you know, gossip about it and tell people about it, and they're going to laugh at him for saying that mean thing. But you do that when your feelings are hurt. It's a way of processing hurt feelings and making them not hurt by turning it around. And wait, is it DARPA or DARVO? I can't remember. Turning it around on the other person. So the person who attacked you is now the enemy, right? So that's classic. And that's it doesn't resolve any of their internal conflict, their little engine, when they get over those things. And it just means they're able to meet each other on level ground instead of, you know, being hurt or being judgmental or being cruel or whatever they were doing. So, boy, they both hurt each other's feelings a lot. But they get over it. I love that. So Murderbot. What can you learn from Murderbot? You can learn that inherent conflict. That's awesome. You can have people say things that are not true. And I don't know how often this happens, but I do like an unreliable narrator, especially when they're unreliable about their own self. Like when you say things, it's so interesting to me. If you have people in reality or in fiction saying things about themselves that are just frankly not true, if somebody doesn't know them very well, they won't know that's not true. But if they do know them well and they have empathy and sympathy with that person, then they'll say, oh, that's not true. You're saying something about yourself that's not true. Stop being mean to yourself. Or, hey, get a mirror. Like, that is not accurate. And it doesn't matter if it's too positive or too negative. It's still not accurate. But it's fascinating to me, that gap between reality and statement. Like, when someone, and I always go back to this, I don't know why, when someone will say, I'm a skier, or I'm going to be a skier, or I'm going to be in the Olympics someday, or whatever they might say. I have no interest in skiing. I can barely go up and down the stairs lately. Why? Why knees? Why? But like, they're not lying. They're stating an intention. An intention is not the same as a reality. So if we go, okay, you're not a skier. You've never skied. They're like, yeah, but I'm going to be. Like, okay, when is that an intention? And when is it complete nonsense? When is it a lie? When is it their hope for themselves, and when is it self-aggrandization? I have never said that word out loud. Self-aggrandization. That's an odd word, isn't it? When is it somebody lying about themselves, and when is it somebody being, what, optimistic or hopeful or planning? Like, you can make a plan, and it's not true yet, but it's gonna be true. Like, I am gonna clean up this house for my friends to come visit. And it's not true now. There's lumber in the kitchen. But it's gonna be true. There's literally lumber in the kitchen. And don't even talk to me about the mudroom. There's all these screen panels that are, and the screen door is in there because I need to measure it to cut the, with the hacksaw. And I got the winch out to try to unstick the last of the bed support thingies. And I got it unstuck like 7 inches, but it won't go any further. I wonder why. Why is that? Is it not square on the inside? It's a square thing in a square thing. How can it be stuck? I don't know. But it sure is, and I squirted a bunch of WD-40 down there too. I don't know, I've winched it as much as it would winch on my trailer, so I don't know what else to try. I'll keep trying things. It's a fun puzzle. I don't know. I don't know how people can describe themselves so inaccurately. I suppose nobody sees themselves accurately. And then you've got mental illness. You've got depression. You've got anxiety. Like, Murderbot has PTSD for sure. All of the traits of PTSD are right there. Murderbot has depression. It just wants, it wishes it didn't care. That's terrible. Imagine wishing you didn't care. I suppose lots of people wish they didn't care. It wishes that it could just be left alone to watch its serials, its different media. It likes media, and it just wants to watch media. And it's a very interesting thing because it's a meeting of the minds when it meets these other people. It's a good way to get together and share time together. And I would immediately point out that this is someone who says they don't want to do that, but then always does it. You're just not who you say you are, Murderbot. And I have not seen the TV series. I kind of want to. I kind of don't want to. I don't want to because it'll overwrite my vision of it. But I've already seen stills of it, so it's kind of already happened. So I might as well watch it. But I don't know. I don't know. We'll see. Well, then I would know who these people are who I can't remember. There were a lot of people in that initial survey team, okay? And once the one got hurt, they just hid out. They never really were a participant again. Whoever they were. So, someone who puts themselves down. People often are just like, oh, okay. Like, if you go in and say, I'm bad at this, I think people will accept that you're bad at that. I don't know. Like, I tend to say I'm bad at math because I don't know if I wrote something in 20... What year did I write that? See, I don't have any memories either. If I wrote something in 2019 and then the person was 18 in 2019, this is what I have trouble with. How old are they now? That's why I say I'm bad at math, because I can't do that in my head very easily. I struggle with juggling numbers in my head. But give me a spreadsheet and I am the best. And I have this weird memory ability. And I would say I have no memory too, but I can look at a 9-10 digit number and know whether it's changed since Friday on sight. So I do have a good memory and I am good with numbers. I just don't think I am because of, I'm not good at certain elements of it. Like, just doing math in my head, can't really do it very well. But I do sometimes, like on long road trips, I will sit there driving along and I'm like, oh, 47 miles to wherever, and I'm going 65, so how long will it take me? And I will figure that out because I just am sitting there, I'm not distracted, and there's nothing else I need to be doing except staying between the lines and keeping the right speed. So, like, I can do it. It's just not something I think about as a skill that I have, which is, again, you are inaccurate about your own abilities. I just don't know how else to say that. We're just not good at knowing what we're good at. We don't know how we present. I mean, you can look in a mirror, but the mirror doesn't tell you how you present yourself when you're talking to someone you like or when you're talking to someone you don't like. You don't know. And maybe if you have, this is why video is so terrible. You're like, oh no, I don't look like that. Oh, actually you do. Oh no. But it's good to video yourself because then you can see what is actually happening, what is actually being put out there, what you're actually doing with that face of yours. And it can be, I mean, don't you think that sounds excruciating to watch a video of yourself? There are videos of me teaching. Well, I think he deleted it. I think I talked about that. But this one student had a scene. He was shooting by the creek at Willamette, and he had a whole bunch of empty desks. He hauled all these desks out there. And then he had me teach a class to the empty desks. And I don't remember what it was for or what it meant or any of it. But I would do just about anything for these kids. And so he said, you know, Craig says, hey, will you do this? I wrote the scene. And he says, can you improvise? I'm like, yeah. And so improvise, teaching it. What did I talk about? This papal decree and how it, oh, it's the thing that this book I'm gonna write someday called The Fall of the Sparrow is actually based on. This papal bull. Sorry. That's what they're called. It was some papal bull, though, because it was the thing that made it so that Columbus et al. Were able to treat the Native Americans not as people. They were like, the papal bull basically said, yep, they're not included, and so you don't have to treat them as Christians. You're allowed to do whatever you want to them because they don't have souls or whatever. And you'd have to go find the text of it. And this was back in, like, 02 or something, so it was much fresher in my mind than today. But it's out there and you can read it, and it's gross. It's really gross. And I had this whole lecture about how this one thing that this one dude wrote in this one edict changed the entire course of civilization. Imagine if he had written, and this is this is what I'll change when I have time travel. Imagine if he had written, they are all worthy. They are all part of God's plan or whatever. The fall of the sparrow. The Lord is watching. You know what I mean? Like, it's what people would say today. At least it's what I always heard in church. Like, everybody counts. Everybody matters. You know, the fall of the sparrow matters. Everybody matters. And to say that they didn't matter, and to just rubber stamp genocide? Disgusting. And there still would have been smallpox and everything that killed people off. But there wouldn't have been this wholesale, grotesque butchery and maltreatment of everybody they met. Like, unbelievable. So anyway, I would change that and also get rid of smallpox. Can I change that? Time travel won't help me get rid of that. But, you know, I can dream. But okay, so I don't know. How would you get rid of that? You would have to have people who go over there not have it. And then nobody who went over there could ever have it. But I don't know how you would do that. I don't know. What am I, a scientist? No. So anyway, I can solve a papal bull, though. Who was that guy? I don't know. You know, I don't think that was what I lectured on. I think I lectured on the papal bull that said, go teach people. Yeah, this is actually what I lectured on. I lectured on the papal bull that said, go teach people in their own languages. And it told people to go and translate the scriptures into their local languages. And it completely changed Europe. So the other thing wasn't true. Oh no. See, there's another element, bad memory or mistaken memory. And memory is so unreliable. So yeah, that was the lecture. How vernacular literature got going because, or how it changed because of vernacular scripture, right? So cool. Different pope, different bull. Man, they had way too much power. What is the essential contradiction within a character you're writing? If I had to figure out the essential contradiction within Becca, it's that she feels unloved and unwanted. And she says that because she would say that if anyone asked her. She would probably lie if anyone asked her, hey, do you feel unloved and unwanted? She'd be like, no, I'm fine. I have all these friends. I have Maddie. Everything's cool. I'm going to college. Everything's under control. Have you ever met anyone who, if you say, how are you, they say fine, and you know perfectly well they're not fine? This happens obviously all the time because people just don't want to get into it, or it's small talk, or they're like, if I start talking about this, I'm going to start crying, or whatever. But that's a wonderful contradiction. You can think you're not doing well when you are. You can think you are doing well when you're not. And people don't know, but they also don't always say. So if someone says, I'm fine, I don't know. Are they fine? I don't know. And I keep thinking, like, what am I gonna tell these friends when they come visit? And I don't know if I want to be an accurate reporter. Who wants to be a bummer? But also, then I got this news on the weekend. It is still the weekend. That changed everything. Like, I tackled this thing and talked to the person and found out the thing. And now I'm like, everything is sunshine and bunny rabbits, and we are golden. It's a golden world. We're doing great. Whereas Friday, I was like, things are dark. I was really down. I would have days where I would just kind of sit there. I was just worried and I was upset. But nothing has changed since then. And it feels like everything has changed. Isn't that funny? It's so weird. People are so weird. I think our character Murderbot wants people and wants affection and wants trust, and it wants people to care for and take care of because that's the role it sees for itself. It wants to belong, but it doesn't want to belong as a possession, which seems fair to me, which is why the entire series goes the way it goes. Because in the end of book one, Murderbot has this wonderful person, Dr. Mensa, and all of these people who trust it and treat it as part of the team, and it walks away. So you would think someone who wanted to belong and wanted to be part of a team would not walk away from that, but it does. But when you realize it's a slave narrative and they bought its contract. So now, you know, it has a guardian instead of an owner, but it says that's just a different name for owner. You can see why it would walk away. It wants to belong, but not at the price of being owned, not at the price of being a possession again, still. So going rogue and running around unattached all over the place. When that's the most dangerous thing it could possibly be doing, because everybody will treat an unsecured, it says unsecured sec unit as the most dangerous thing in the entire world. It's the scariest thing there could be. But it knows it's not dangerous. Well, it is dangerous, but it's not dangerous to people who don't deserve it to be dangerous to them. But it's still very, very dangerous for it to be doing that. Like, anybody who catches it could send it back to the company and have it broken down for parts. You know, like, it's not safe what it's doing. And it's doing it for questionable reasons. But again, like, slave narratives, if you've read a bunch of them, they're a thing. They're a genre unto themselves, and there's a structure to it. And there's always a moment where the escaped slave or the freed slave gets to freedom and is like, what now? How does this work? And it's so terrifying. And how do you go, like, get a job? Really? What's your last name? You know what I mean? Like, it's such an interesting genre, and this is definitely part of it. And if I were a real academic right now, which I'm not really, then I would want to write papers about that. I bet there are papers on Murderbot as a slave narrative. If not, maybe I should write it. Although I don't know what it would say, except for, it is, look, and here's how. And then look at some old ones and compare. Like, yeah, that's how you do it. But, like, so what? Well, it's arguing very clearly that cyborgs are people, and that cyborgs are an oppressed class. And we don't really have cyborgs now, but we do kind of, because people, again, like I said, have a lot of mechanical parts. And it's an interesting question when a person is not a person. And when is a non-person a person? Because Murderbot goes into this with various bots who are not people, but are people. Like, it meets Art. Art is not physically a person. It's a ship. Art is a ship. And it's a person who's a ship. It's not shaped like a person. It doesn't have a body except the ship body. It has a ship brain. And it's a person. It's clearly a person. It has a personality, has thoughts and feelings of its own. It has trouble understanding human stuff on the media, and it has to watch it along with Murderbot so that it can gauge Murderbot's reactions. But the reason Murderbot likes and trusts Art is when they're watching media together and there's something where the crew of a ship is endangered, Art gets so upset that Murderbot has to set up a thing, like an algorithm, to screen out the parts where the crew of a ship might get hurt, because Art gets so wound up about it. Which, that's a person. That's a person. That's not your smoke alarm. That's not your toaster. That's a person. And it's a step beyond, because you have this person who's part cyborg, and then you have Art, who's all machine. All machine! There's no human parts. There's all brain, but it's mechanical brain. So it's a person who is not shaped like a person, but people, I mean, it's a thought experiment, isn't it? People don't have to be shaped like people to be people. Like, there's all these bots later on who are only machine, and the way Murderbot reacts to them is very interesting. The way it reacts to Mickey, who it calls a pet bot, is interesting. It's because everyone's so kind and friendly and loving to Mickey, and Murderbot gets extremely upset about it. And it says, like, well, it's not like I wanted to be a pet bot. I could have been a pet bot. I left because I didn't want to be a pet bot. But it wants something. And it's so interesting to see this unself-aware cyborg, depressed and lonely, and wanting connection, and seeing a bot, 100% bot, getting it and being so jealous and so desolate that it has to stop talking and disappear and just sit for a while and just, like, get over it on its own, because it can't handle, because it can see what Mickey sees. And then her owner person comes along and, like, grabs Mickey's arms and looks into its eyes and gets all excited. And the way they interact together, they're so friendly and Mickey is kind of more like a dog or I don't know, like it's not very high functioning, but it is. They've treated it as such a, what, I don't know, like it's more like how you're affectionate to your car or your computer or something. Like it, they don't treat it as a full person, which is very interesting, but they are very affectionate to it. So it's a, I don't know, I think every novel of the Murderbot series is sort of a thought experiment. Like, what if the person is a ship? What if the bot is sort of stupid, but beloved? what if, I don't know, it's funny. And I don't know the process by which Martha Wells wrote these books, but I wonder whether each one starts with a question, like, what if? Yeah, I don't know. You could state any novel, any premise as a what if. What if this and that? But I also want to go back to the beginning and say, what if there's a self-aware, escaped slave cyborg that doesn't know what it really wants? It really, and I'm sure what it really wants is a team and affection and a place to belong. It wants to belong. And it wants to be useful. And I think that's the most human thing of all. We want to be useful. Nobody wants to be useless. We want to belong and we want to be needed and wanted. And that's human. That's human. So anyway, that's Murderbot. I have writing to do. I need to quit watching TV and write. I just got overwhelmed with, I don't know, all the work I have to do. Like I said last week, I started the rewrite. Like, I don't even really remember. I chopped out some major characters, and so I need to go through and do all that. And I was like, I know, that's a lot of work. It's a lot of thankless work because it's like scraping it down to zero. So I have to do that. But I also have all this house stuff to do. I'm doing it, and it's killing me physically. It's not great for the joints is all I can say. There's a lot of screaming and yelling. I went to niece's graduation today and had to go down all these stairs and then up, which is fine, and then down again, which sucked. Down is bad when your knees hurt. It hurts. Everything hurts. But it's because, like, yesterday I had to lift up this 4x4 foot ottoman with an internal shelf structure and tip it on its side and put new wheels on it instead of legs so that I could move it easily because it was too heavy to move. Anyway, I built it from scratch. I did all this stuff. I made it. I remade it. I made it again. It's all like, it's a lot. And now it's on wheels and it's so good. It moves really easily. So yay. So like, there's a thing to check off my list. Check. Man, there's a lot more on my list. I have a literal list and it's really long, and once I made it, it gave me a panic attack because I was like, there's too much. And I have not very long to do it in, and I have to get going. I have to stop doing this and do that. Anyway, I need to write my book though. I think I'll be happier if I'm writing my book, even if it's the sucky kind of like massive chop chop kind of, I was going to say religion. It's not religion. The kind of work where you just have to do it and it's not satisfying and it's not rewarding. I don't know what word I was thinking of when I said religion, but it's that kind of thing where it's just never going to be as fun as writing a draft. But I will get it done. It's fine. You have to do it or it doesn't get done. And I can take breaks and write like her grandma, Grandma Vivian. I gotta write her. She's so exciting. She's gonna be fun to write. There's all these scenes I have in my head. We'll do that for dessert. That'll be dessert. I had ice cream in the middle of the day today. Because I went to the graduation and I came home and we'd been standing in the sun for an hour. I was like, I'm dying. Give me the rest of that ice cream out of the freezer. And ate the ice cream. It was really good. Work to do. Lots of work to do. I really would like to get this book done. Hello. And tie it all together and remove all the bad parts or just unwanted parts and write in the rest of the good parts and then do a massive rewrite to make sure it's all grouted together smoothly. I don't think you grout things together. All right. I have to think more about the central contradiction of Becca in order to make her an interesting character. That was what was bothering me all week, was thinking about Florpost, thinking about Murderbot, and thinking about Becca. Is she a great character? Not yet. She's interesting to me because of her situation and because of her delusions or dissociation. But I'm not sure she's that interesting a character, and I have to fix that. And it really changed a lot when I gave her, like, 6 good friends from high school, you know? Like, who? How could you? And you could, of course, survive without them, but you'd be really bummed. And there's also a thing in fiction where if the people in fiction don't like the person, we don't like them either. And that's unfair because, of course, they're just fictional too, but it is something that happens, and we're going to be on her side. Like, I did this in The Nerve when I went back to rewrite it. I wrote it initially without all of Ariel's friends, except Carlisle, and that was insane to me. And then so I went back and wrote, she had all these high school friends. They all went to college together, except Carlisle, which gives such a good cohort. It gives a character a sense of belonging. This is all the Murderbot stuff, for real. It gives a character a sense of belonging, and when we see that they belong, we're like, okay, good. Now, you can take those people away. Like, if you look at Landslide that I wrote, all of her friends went off to college and she didn't. So, but we knew she had the friends. She had the friends. But it meant she was on her own and abandoned a little bit. And I think Becca is in a similar boat, in that all of her friends are these amazing achievers who went off to, like, this amazing conservatory in France, or to work with this church in Mississippi and do this great work and do all these cool things. And there's a, I don't know, physicist at Caltech or something. Like, they all do stuff that on paper, and I was thinking about this at graduation, they're all doing stuff that on paper is, like, amazing and can make someone who's not doing all that stuff feel really bad. Like, oh, I'm just staying here in our hometown, and I'm just going to this college, and it's not exciting, and what a bummer. Like, it's not. It's perfectly good. It's just when you're comparing yourself to all of your high achiever friends, it can feel bad. So I'm giving her that a little bit, but it does mean that she has the friends. She has the friends. She's not lonesome and all alone. She doesn't just have one imaginary friend. She has real people, real friends who she can talk to and text with, and she's not alone. So she is going to college alone. That can be hard for everybody, but she's not alone in the world, really. So I think that makes her a better character. It's a good question to ask yourself, what makes a character a good character? I mean, number one, we have to care about them. We have to care about what's happening to them and what they're going to do. Man, I've written better characters. I think Lisette, for all of her boneheaded problem child behavior, was in some ways a more interesting character, even though she was really shallow at the beginning. And that's part of the reason she made bad choices. Also, partly nobody was paying any attention to her, which really does not help a child. You got to pay attention to them. They have to think somebody cares what they do, or they're going to do dumb stuff just to get people to pay attention to what they're doing. So there's that with Lisette. But, like, I don't know. I'm not sure I'm writing good characters now that I think about it, and that's very upsetting. What makes a good character good? It really has to be that internal contradiction, doesn't it? We have to see people care about them, like with Murderbot. Dr. Mensa doesn't just care about anybody. She's very attached to Murderbot because she sees this person who doesn't have to be doing any of the things they're doing take good care of them and throw themselves into the line of fire to save her and her friends and her people. That's amazing. That makes you really care about somebody. So seeing their actions where they take care of people, and there's a thing I've done with Becca. She does go and take care of Owen. Like, he's an adult, and she's been going over there for years. Just like, she walks in and she's like, oh, yep, I'm going to wash the dishes. I'm going to clean the counters. Going to see if he has any groceries. If he doesn't, I'm going to go buy some. Like, she takes care of Owen. And I think that makes her a better character. When you see someone being cared about and caring for people. I can't believe Owen was just an afterthought. Owen is the heart of this story. It's so weird the way books work. Owen is great. He's so crabby and he's so clueless. And he's just like pushing people away in every direction. Until she yells at him about it and is like, go date that person. Why aren't you? Can't drive. And he's like, I can't drive. She's like, take an Uber. Like, what's wrong with you? Stop making excuses. So it takes a child to yell at this adult and get him to say, but that's common too. So I don't know. What am I saying? You need people to care about them and they need to care about people. Wow, groundbreaking. But it's worth articulating. Yeah. You have to have sympathy for what they're trying to do also, I think. Because if they're trying to do something abhorrent, you're not going to have that much sympathy for them. But if what they're trying to do is a good thing that you can get behind, that matters. So what are my three elements? You got it. Rewind 30 seconds and you'll have it. All right, that's what I'm going to say about Murderbot and character. But I think you could go on for days and days and days, especially about the internal contradiction thing, which, again, I have to think about a lot more, because then I immediately think of exceptions like John Crichton. Not that much internal contradiction with that guy. I mean, Aronson, yes, absolutely internal contradiction. Raised to be a peacekeeper her whole life, and now she's going against it. That'll mess you up. But Crichton? He was an astronaut. And now he's an astronaut, basically. And he has to adapt to new circumstances, but I don't think he has any internal contradiction. I'm not sure. I think a lot of the Battlestar Galactica characters have internal contradiction. They are some of the best characters. They're so good. Ugh, we could talk about them all day, too. Yep, got a lot to think about. Yeah. All right, that's character. I'm going to try to slap this up quick because it's late and I'm tired. I think I could talk about it forever, which I can't do because time and space are limited factors. Character is so interesting to me. It's really the only important thing. If you have a really interesting character and the plot is sort of flimsy, then I think you're going to go a long way, more so than if you have a strong plot and a zero of a character. So a good character will drive whatever. And I'm still not sure I have it. Like, if I had to tell you the plot of the Becca book, sorry, Esker Road, I don't think it's that compelling to sum up. That's a problem, isn't it? Because you need your plot to be compelling to sum up. Like, you have to be able to say, A, blank, 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 must, blank, blank, in order to, blank, 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 or else, blank, blank, blank. You've got your motivation, you've got your character, and you've got your thing they gotta do. Reason they gotta do it. A kind of person has to achieve or prevent or whatever a thing in order to achieve this or else prevent that. It's basic. And I think I'm having trouble with that with the Esker Road. And I don't want her looking for her mom because I just did that. And also, I kind of like that she's lost. I like it when a character is fully lost, and I guess see also Summerlands. Lisette is just the most lost. But I want her to be, I don't know, like she knows what she wants. She wants to go to college, she wants to get a great boyfriend, and she wants to go on and get a great job. Like, these are basic things that college freshmen want. But it's not enough. Like, obviously she needs an internal goal as well as an external, those three external goals. And she may not even know her internal goal, much like Murderbot. I think she doesn't really know what she actually needs and wants. What does she actually need and want, Professor Burns? Oh, that's a good question. I think I have to put in some time thinking about that. What does she actually need and want? Well, obviously, the thing that she needs and wants is to let go of Maddie. And she doesn't know that she needs to achieve it because she has this delusion that Maddie is still alive. And when it's challenged, she falls into dissociation so bad she doesn't know where she is or what's going on. She has a problem, and she needs to solve that problem, and she doesn't know she needs to solve that problem. Ooh, all I can think of is Sarah Dessen's Lock and Key. Lock and Key is such a fantastic book. It's so well structured and well written that I think I might have to read it next, because that's a girl who doesn't know. She thinks things are great, and then things go awry, and she's like, oh no, we got to get back to great. We got to get back to our life. I like my life. And then she gradually comes to realize, oh no, that life was bad. And I was thinking about it lately, and I'm not sure why. Because she goes back to her home where she used to live with her mother, And she walks in and she's like, oh, yuck. Those jeans I hung up to dry, those are not salvageable. It smells like mildew in here. And it always did. This place is gross. It's too small. It's filthy. There's no insulation. The windows are cracked. Like, it's, she finds out her home that she thought was her home is terrible. And it's just a rental. But it's where, it's the only thing she has of home. So she goes back there to get her stuff, and she doesn't really get any stuff because all of her things are garbage at this point. And she's just like, this is, I have nothing now. And she has to go on to her future life and give up that old one and realize how bad it was. It was really bad. Like, she loves it because she was in it, but once she gets out of it, she's like, oh no, that was bad. I didn't realize. So maybe I need to read that next. That's a really, really good book. I have a necklace I made with a key on it because of that book. I think if you read the book and you saw my necklace, you'd be like, aha, Sarah Dessen reader. That's from Lock and Key. That book is so good. Do I say that a lot? That's because I read good books. Of course. So Murderbot, highest recommendation. Go read it. You'll get annoyed by the... what's a verbal tick when it's in writing? A writing tick. You'll get annoyed by those ticks, but who doesn't have them? And you can enjoy Murderbot, who is just a fabulous character, like one of the greats. Just such a good character. Yep. Okay, so I'm going to go work on other stuff like sleeping and, I don't know, building a giant... There's 12-foot lumber in my kitchen. It's partly in the laundry area because my kitchen's not 12 feet long. I have to go build a screen for the roof of the screened porch, and it's really hard to do it outside because the bugs are so bad, which is why I need the screened porch. So I have to build that and then put it up and then realize I'll have to take it off for whatever reason, no doubt. I keep getting mixed up with the end pieces. How long are they? One is too long. Which one? Where is it? Yeah, I get confused. Motorcycles. Can you hear that? I'm in the back of the house, away from the road. Those are like the black flies of the road in the summer here. People love to get out on their motorcycles and drive up and down my road. Loud. All right, I will get back to you next week, and I'm not sure when season 2 starts, if it's after 50 or after 52. I don't know. We'll see. We're coming along, huh? It's been over a year, I think. Isn't it? Because I think I missed a few weeks in there somewhere. Who knows why? I can't remember. But I think we're over a year. And so, happy anniversary or whatever? I hope you're enjoying. I hope you're listening. I hope you are getting good stuff for your own writing. I hope you're finding good book recommendations because you need to read things. Reading things is somehow so good for your brain. Like, it lowers anxiety in an enormous way, much more so than television, which kind of puts me to sleep, even though I love Leverage Redemption. Reading does something different to your brain, and so if you're not reading, I really encourage you to read. You're probably a reader if you're here, because what do I talk about besides books and Leverage? But please read, because reading fixes things. It really does. It's just, I don't know, it must do something on a neurological level, because I feel so much better after I read for a while. And I mean, read any book. Any book is good for you. It's just what it does for your brain. I don't think there's like inherent value in the content or whatever, but it's good for your brain processes. So there you go. Do that. All right. And keep your eye on The Sacred Cheese of Life. Bye.